Do economic sanctions work? That's what Duncan Weldon will be investigating later, as he looks back on 100 years of foreign policy to find out if and when sanctions have been effective. The cost of economic war is at 8 o'clock.
He could be aloof, shy, miserable.
The poet laureate, Simon Armitage, reassesses the power of Philip Larkin's poetry.
There are moments of wry humour in there, and also occasions of ecstasy.
Examining 10 different poems in his centenary year.
There's an ugly side to Larkin. I thought it was a good time to see whether these poems still stood up to a contemporary audience.
Larkin Revisited with Simon Armitage.
Begins next Monday to Friday afternoon at 1:45 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, Andrew Maxwell continues his stand-up series investigating jobs and the ever-changing world of work. This week, his focus is on status and why some jobs are valued differently to others.
Hello, I'm Andrew Maxwell and this is my Radio 4 series about jobs and the world of work. You join me once again in my office at the bottom of the garden, which I'm still insisting is not a shed. It's radio after all, so you can't see the lawnmower in the corner. In this episode, we're going to be talking about politics, money, and why certain occupations are valued more than others. My guest is Mark Blythe, a political economist at Brown University in America. Don't let his Dundee accent fool you. And he's written a book called Angrynomics, which, amongst other things, talks about why workers are angry about their current working conditions. Can you explain in a nutshell why that is?
Yeah, it'd be a big nutshell, but I'll try and make it somewhat concise.
More from Mark later. But first, here's me on stage trying to make a bunch of strangers laugh and asking them a few big questions on the way. Why do we work? Seems such an obvious question. Why do we work?
Money.
Money, absolutely, for money. But we work beyond money, don't we? Yeah. We work for status, right? Everybody does. It explains why Prince Charles makes biscuits. He doesn't need to. He's going to inherit a kingdom. But he wants to be impressive amongst other European royal families, right? Go to a royal wedding in Copenhagen. You want to be able to impress your royal cousins. So, Charles, what are you doing now?
Biscuits.
What kind of biscuit?
Organic.
Oh, that's very impressive. Where do you sell them?
Waitrose.
That's truly impressive. I feel pathetic now, being the head of an international wildlife charity. Status. We work for status. We work for flattery. Some years ago, I got a call out of the blue going, would you like to do a gig in St. Helier in the Channel Islands? Recently reopened opera house. I know. And this, I literally just started working on the news quiz. I was like, wow. Radio 4's power works quickly. Last week I was working in the Chuckle Hut in Leytonstone. 1 week later, I'm in an opera house. They went, yes, we've just renovated the opera house and we would like you to be the first person on the stage. I was like, oh, of course. There's me in my head that I was going to do a tight 20 before, you know, some opera. I turned up there. I was doing a gig to all the builders. It was the builders, the men who just finished building the opera house. They were still in their high vises and helmets, sitting on plastic sheeting in the opera house. We had a great evening. I doubt if any of us have been in an opera house since. That's the power of flattery, you know? I think personally what bestows, I've been doing this job 30 years, being a stand-up comedian. I think what bestows a certain amount of the status on it is the danger. Everybody knows, that's what I love. You know, that's what I didn't realize how much I loved. I missed it during the 2 years that I was locked in my house doing gigs online, on Zoom. What I missed was the danger. A live audience like you, people right in front of me in Southeast London. Right? Any one of you, if I upset you, could just come up here and punch me.
I just point out the fact that your wife is clearly bald, you can get up here and hit me in the head. And that's what gives our job, I believe, the status, you know? I've been attacked on stage a couple of times. Once in 2014 at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, I did a show debunking the arguments on both sides of the Scottish independence referendum. But only one side got offended. I was on stage, it was Saturday night. God, I love Scottish people. Saturday night, this guy comes out. 5 minutes into the show, this guy comes thundering down the steps. And he got to the front and he shouted something like, Scotland, or whatever he shouted, you know. Right? And he threw a pint at my head. Full pint, at point blank range. Now, luckily, it was one of those really squidgy pint glasses, but he smashed me right in the head and the pint went all over me. And he just went, Scotland, something like that, right? And this is so great. Instantly, everybody around him in the room went, no, screw you, and threw their drinks over him. The best one, I was doing a Christmas party in Nottingham. And I don't know what I said, but there was this old boy in the front row of the gig. And now, not only did he not laugh, he was really upset. He was so upset. He got on stage in front of the whole audience, took off his prosthetic leg and tried to beat me to death with it. I don't know what I'd said, but this man was literally hopping mad. These are the jokes, people.
I'm Mark Blythe. I teach political economy at Brown University in Rhode Island, and I wrote a book in 2020 called Angrynomics.
People are angry. Can you explain in a nutshell why that is?
It'd be a big nutshell, but I'll try and make it somewhat concise. If you go back to our dad's and mum's day, there used to be things called unions, and they maybe had lots of problems, but they basically protected you from the arbitrary whims of employers. There were kind of collective agreements on what you could do, what you couldn't do, what your hours were, all the rest of it. Over the past 30 years, if not 40 years, pretty much all the whip in that hand has been passed on to business. So they get to determine hours, whether you have any at all with 0 hours contracts. They get to determine rates of compensation. There's a great book by a guy called Brett Christophers about the economy of rents in the United Kingdom called Rentier Capitalism. And what he shows is that pretty much the whole British economy now isn't defined by productivity and innovation. It's defined by the control of assets. So if you own something that everybody else has to use, you have to pay a fee. And when you do that, you end up with this incredibly sclerotic economy, whereby most of the profits are made basically from squeezing labor at the bottom. And that squeeze has moved from the bottom to the middle, in some cases getting close to the top. And that's why people are pissed.
There is pecking order to jobs. And it's not just about how much you get paid. You know, we live in an economy that is vastly a service industry. Most people have a service industry job that, frankly, people struggle to explain what it is to other human beings, right? And politicians know this. One of the things that I discovered while researching this problem, there's a thing called the Richard Scarry rule, right? It's an American political science rule. And Richard Scarry was a guy who made kids' books, okay? Some of you may know who he is. You know, and in kids' books, all the jobs are kids' books jobs. There's the baker, there's the fireman, there's the fisher. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Quantifiable jobs. Right? And the rule simply states that a politician should never publicly criticize an industry that's in a kid's book. You can rip all you want to the service sector. You know, this city we're standing in, London, right now, is built on the service sector. But nobody knows what they do, so it doesn't matter. Right? But it's jobs that people can have an emotional attachment. Ah, yes, I understand that job. You know? Look at the example of this. What swung the referendum? The Brexit referendum? Fishing. Exactly. Fishing. People know what it is. People have an attachment to the fishing industry, despite the fact it's a fraction of 1% of the British economy. Right? In fact, twice as much of the British economy comes from leather working. But there's a big difference there, isn't there? When you think of fishing and fishermen, you think the heroics of the deep sea. You think of the small boats in the Second World War who ventured across being strafed by the Nazis to land on the beach in Dunkirk to save the British Army at the last moment. And when you think of leather, you think of perverts. You think of perverts and Germans. Again, you know, the referendum, the Remain side, who do they put out? Experts. Experts in their field of expertise in their specific high-yield service industries. Straight over people's heads. Who did Leave put out? They put out the fella who knocks out cheap beer. the fella who makes Hoovers. And Timpsons. You know, the key cutters and cobblers attached to a big Sainsbury's. Yeah. It turns out people will only take cobblers from cobblers. Thank you. Thank you for getting that 48% of the applause in this room. That's the reality of it. These are the jobs that we can sort of grab hold of and imagine. Because the vast majority of jobs in the economy in the UK are the service industry. People on laptops doing stuff. Who knows what they're doing? You know what I mean? Like Mummy Pig. What's she doing on that laptop? Who knows? She's probably on Mum's Net. Mummy Pig on Mum's Net, just banging on about what men pigs are. It's the emotional attachment. And the government know this. I'm sure you'll know it when I say it to you. But the most extraordinary thing about it, this is everywhere. This desire to come back to these kids' jobs. Jobs we can get our heads around, you know? It's even how this British government communicate with us. They speak like postmen. If you've ever listened to them, there they are. Well, we want to move on from that and deliver. We're here to deliver for the country. We're delivering for Britain. And every time I hear that, I think, no, you're the government. Your verb is to govern. Please, this is a heartfelt plea. If there is any political journalists listening to this, the next time you're interviewing a government minister and they said they want to deliver for Britain, I want you to look them in the eye and say, can we have a tracker number, please? How do we stop people being angry? I mean, what's the solution here?
How about stop being totally horrible to your workers? How much profit is normal? Right now in the United States, corporate profits are at the highest they have ever been. And at the same time, we're saying, oh, got to watch out for those wage increases. That might cause inflation. Well, how about we actually take something from the top and give it back to the bottom rather than the giant sucking up sound that we've had for the past 40 years, whereby all of the profits and revenues and returns have gone to a tiny, vanishingly small fraction of the population.
You don't realise just how important the status that your job conveys on you until you become a parent. When you're a parent, eventually your kid goes to school. And one day they come home from school because they've been learning about jobs. And part of the exercise is, what does your mummy and daddy do for a living? And that's pretty straightforward. If you're a leather worker, or a fisherman, or a postman, when you're a stand-up comedian, you know, I remember one of my daughters, she was six, she came home, she went, Daddy, what do you do? What's your job? I was like, I'm a stand-up comedian. And she said, what's that? I said, I tell jokes. It's obviously begged the six-year-old question, tell me a joke. And I had to explain to her, no, I don't tell jokes per se. I more have a wry take on modern society. She was like, oh, Daddy, that's not funny. And off she went. Then one day we were at a comedy festival in Ireland, and there's such a thing as comedy for kids, where you got adult comedians and the audience is parents and their little nippers. and you've got to try and entertain the kids. And we went along. I wasn't even on, but we went along as a family because I was still rankled by, oh, she has to know what I do. So we went along, we were at the back of the gig, and there was a quite a famous American comedian, and he died very badly in front of this room of rowdy little Irish children. And by the way, six-year-olds are the nastiest hecklers in the world. There's no messing around. They stand up on the chair and go, not good. You know what I mean? There's no escaping from that. That's point blank range. She turned to me and went, Daddy, is that what you do? This cannot stand. This cannot be. So I went up beside her and went, is there any chance I can go on? They're like, yeah, go ahead. So I went up. Now in Ireland, we've got a thing called Club Orange. It's like Fanta, only it's orangier and it's fizzier and it's got stuff in it. Hopefully I'm selling that to you. So I went on stage in front of all these kids. I went, you kids stink. And they're like, boo. No, kids rule. Grown-ups stink. Shut up, you stupid kids. Grown-ups rule. They're now up on their chairs. Boo. No, kids rule. Grown-ups rule. Which one of you stinky kids could get a mortgage approved? You're nothing. None of you has a national insurance number. I'm going to prove it. They're all in uproar, Boomy. I'm going to prove it. I'm going to drink this entire can of extremely fizzy Club Orange in one go. Something no stinky kid could do. And they were like, oh. I hadn't drank one in years. I drink Guinness. I forgot about bubbles. Popped it open and went, rawr, rawr. Like, I was like that much into the can and all of a sudden it's streaming out my nose. I'm gagging, I'm just orange snot pouring. I've got a very badly deviated septum, so orange stuff is coming out of my eyeballs. I'm on the floor retching, like, rah, rah. The kids are just overjoyed. I bumbled back and sat back down, just wiping this gunk off my face. And I went, did you like that? And she went, and my daughter went, well, I laughed. I don't know why. Yeah, you and 25 years worth of Edinburgh Fringe reviewers, baby.
Now, here's how you get a wage rise. Tell me you're a good worker and ask me for a wage rise.
I'm a fabulous worker. Can I have a wage rise, please?
No. Now, what recourse have you got to change that? Nothing.
I suppose I could whinge online.
Now, what I can do, though, is I can say, oh, costs are going through the roof. It's absolutely terrible. We have to, unfortunately, pass this on to our customers, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a terrible thing that, like, our profits margins are staying high. But at the same time, your wages will stay low to ensure that those profit margins are staying high. Anyone who says this is not going on is being willfully blind.
It's like, as I looked into this, it's like even what we get paid has different names. Isn't that strange? Who here gets paid a wage? Right. Yeah. Who here gets paid a salary? Yes. Right. Well, us comedians, we don't get either of those. We get paid a fee, which makes us more like a round of golf than a human being. Well, the thing that I didn't realise as I looked into this, that the executive class, the business class, I assumed CEOs got paid a salary. They don't. They get paid compensation. I thought, what an odd term. But then I thought, actually, if you have to be coaxed off the yacht to go into the office, you probably would need to be compensated, wouldn't you? Yeah, your boss, the CEOs, they get paid compensation. And then within that, it's called the compensation package. And the largest section within your compensation package is called short-term incentives, or STIs, which are considered incredibly rude to share. Most of us don't even know where money comes from, what it is. But it's so key to our lives and key to our status in our lives. Back home in Dublin, there's one of my mate's big brother's a cop. One time he was arresting this junkie and he was sticking this junkie into the back of the cop car, you know, with the whole head down, all indignant. The dude turned around, the junkie turned around all indignant and went, "Here, watch it, will you? My dole pays your wages." Maybe. You know, while researching this, what I realised is you have to ask for a pay rise, particularly in a time of hyperinflation, or certainly high inflation. You've got to ask for a pay rise. That's one of the many things that, while researching this, one of the key reasons of the gender pay gap. Women just simply don't ask for a raise as much as men. And it doesn't matter whether you're a man or a woman. During this inflation cycle we're going through, you must ask for a pay rise. Okay? If you don't, all you've actually done in reality is auto-enrolled yourself in a demotion. It's key. And listen to me, people. Don't ever buy into there's no such thing as the magic money tree. Right? It's what we were told after the 2008 crash. Sorry. There's no such thing as the magic money tree. Yeah? And austerity absolutely tore through the bottom ranks of the British society. Turns out, and then when COVID struck and it hit every sector and every class of British society, oh no, it turns out there's a whole magic money forest. It just happens all this time the acorns have been squirreled away in the Cayman Islands. You know, you don't pay attention to money. The money men do, right? As you looked into the history of work, what was the original writing on Earth? Was it love poetry? Was it even battle poetry? No. The Sumerians in what is now Iraq invented writing for accountancy. Yeah. That's where money comes from. Writing it down, you was 14 bushels. So boring. But that's where it is. And I think it's because we're so intimidated by money and where we fit in the status pile of our society, we never ask. And next thing, they've done it, whether we wanted it or not. 2008 crash. I'm not some sort of weird commie. I'm plugged into the financial system. I'm with Lloyds. Come on, like, I have every right to be furious here, people. This is a bank that was so venal and incompetent in 2008, all of us taxpayers in this room and listening in Radioland had to bail them out. And what was the first thing they did with the bailout? They got new ads on TV. Laughing at me! Are you with Lloyds? I don't like how things are set up in an oppositional way, generation against generation. But when it comes to the wealth and status in this country, it is stark. Through the housing. Simple as that. There's a huge generational gap. And it's not only this government, any British government is always going to chase the baby boomer generation's votes because they vote. And they have skin in the economic game. They have property. You know what I mean? So it doesn't matter whether it's right for the long-term economy. It's just how it is. Every politician is going to chase after the vote of somebody who bought a house for a tenner. It's not hard to feel sorry for younger generations. Older generations got a job for life. A job for life. If you're under 35 in this country, you'll never know what that is. Younger people in Britain don't get a job for life. They get a bag for life. Not quite the same, is it? Itchy bag with a little ladybird on it. The generation gap used to be about how long your hair was, you know? Whether you wanted to listen to Mario Lanza or you wanted to listen to Led Zeppelin.
Yes.
But from your perspective as a political economist, how do you level the playing field for younger generations?
So we've already seen a little experimental version of this in the Eurozone about 10 years ago when they had the European bond market crisis. And they doubled down on that by doing those austerity budgets. Well, one of the things that did in Southern Europe was it meant 4 million Italians and about 1 million Greeks basically said, I'm not staying here anymore because there's no point. What does that do? This is part of the reason why Italy hasn't grown in at least 20 years. And part of that's compounded by the fact that the young people who would be the most inventive, the most productive, the most entrepreneurial, the ones who are going to earn incomes over time, are going to scale those incomes upwards, are going to pay the taxes at the end of the day, simply aren't going to be there. They're gone. So a functional equivalent of that is to create a world where baby boomers have everything, will pay for absolutely nothing. Remember, Theresa May getting defenestrated for even mentioning a long-term care tax, right? So you've got this incredible skew, not just to the top, but given the fact that people's incomes and wealth compound over time, towards the old. Millennials are now actually equivalent in numbers to boomers. It's just that boomers vote twice as much. The political parties skew all their policies towards them because they know that they'll be elected if they do. We have an oldocracy alongside a democracy, and we need to change that, particularly in a climate-shocked world where, again, it's our generation and older that should be paying for this because we're the people that caused the mess, and we're just kicking it back to future generations.
So what do we value more than status? We value happiness. Again, when I was researching this, I looked into all these surveys of what's the happiest job. Who's happy? Number one, happiest job in the UK is primary school education care assistant. Happiest. Don't get paid the most, obviously, but by far the highest level of job satisfaction. Number two, it's kind of sad, but it's kind of obvious, it's the CEO class. They've got a boat and a bird, haven't they? Do you know what I mean? Here's the weird thing. Number three, third happiest job in the UK, park keeper. Oh, do you know how it is to get to 48 years old to realise the Beano was lying all this time? The one that it surprised me is in the survey of who's happy, who's content with their job. My sector, arts and entertainment. 6% of people in arts and entertainment hate their job. What? Well, that's easily remedied. If you hate being in the arts and entertainment, all you've got to do is sink a bottle of whiskey, get yourself online, tell the world what you really think, and in the morning, you won't be in show business anymore. What's valuable to people is profoundly personal. My mate's parents, they're super Catholic. And that really means something in Ireland. They went on holidays to the Vatican. That's more the mom. The mom's super into it. The dad goes along with it because he loves her. So they went to the Vatican and they queued up for hours. You know, you've got to get there at dawn, queued up to see the Sistine Chapel, right? Michelangelo's masterpiece. We've all seen it, right?
Yeah.
God and man almost touching fingers, yeah. Right? You got to queue for hours and then you're like in there for like 10 minutes maximum, whatever it is, and then you're shuffled out the door. And they went in and they looked around and my mate's man was saying there was a look on his face like, I'd never seen anything like it. He's never, you know, really. But he was visibly moved as he looked up at the ceiling. There was like tears in his eyes. And she'd never seen him react like that before. And as they came out the other side, she went, did you like that? He was like, that was mind blowing. She was like, really? And he was like, yeah. The scaffolding. You think the scaffolding that would have had to gone into that. My name's Andrew Maxwell. Thank you and goodbye. Andrew Maxwell Values was written and performed by me, Andrew Maxwell. The producer was Richard Morris, and it was a BBC